How much for the Buddha? How much for the Dharma? How much for the Sangha? Thanks for coming today. So I would like to talk this morning about a specific kind of practice that I think we all undertake at times and try to put it in context within the broader arc of practice over time in our lives. And my hope is that doing this adds a little clarity and makes it easier to be more skillful about how we make use of this and when we do it. And this is an area that I hear confusion about with some regularity in sansen or discussions. So some of this might be a little bit technical, but I want this to be practical, so bear with me through the details if that's, and there will be time for questions. So the primary category of practice that I want to focus on here is substitution or like replacement. It's what we do when we recognize that there's some kind of process underway that isn't going to work out for us, and we interrupt it by putting something, something in the cognitive emotional realm that we recognize and we know through past experience is going to lead to suffering. It's going to be unwholesome. And there's a conscious, purposeful decision to shift the awareness onto something that we also recognize through past experience is going to be more wholesome, is not going to lead via chain of causation to more suffering. So, people recognize that so far? Yeah, okay, we all do this, yeah. It's pretty effective if, like, the basic conditions are satisfied, right? It's a good method to have in your bag of contemplative tricks. And so what I want to kind of focus on is how this fits in with other techniques and some of the pros and cons. Even though this is a really kind of foundational, basic, simple practice, I'll bet that we all have times when we didn't do it and wish we had, or tried to do it and it didn't really work, or didn't work for long enough, or didn't work with enough intensity. And, so it's not easy. There's a lot going on. So how do we fail at something that's so simple? That's what I want to start with. It's something, it's not nothing. It's something, with some significance to catch ourselves in an unwholesome state of mind, right? That the mind which is experiencing doesn't want to be caught there, right? It's states of mind that are like that are splashy and distracting and slip around, and they show up when we're less resourced and less able to notice that experience with clarity and equanimity. So, there's some difficulty there in just catching that reactivity or that selfing happening. And so it usually takes some repetition, right? We have to see that target again and again and again. Or some degree of familiarity built up there. And we need that familiarity because we need to recognize it both when it's just sprouting, when it's kind of an inkling of an unwholesome thought, recognize it when it's fully flourishing and proliferating, and also recognize like what that means, like what's, several steps down the chain, what it feels like. And if we can recognize that whole progression, the arising, the appearing, the disappearing of a phenomenon like that, then it's much easier to catch it, to recognize it. That to some extent there's some labeling that may happen there, but there's like a visceral kind of precision that is really helpful there. That when we recognize what it's like, that's when we have the kind of clarity with it that provides useful leverage. So the acuity of our mindfulness practice, the kind of steadiness of our mindfulness practice, is what helps us get that leverage. So we catch ourselves, we're starting to do something which is going to lead to an ow. That's great. We can replace it with a more wholesome state, something which is less likely to lead to an ow. Not all landing spots, right? Not all other options are equal. We have lots of kind of habitual places where we'll shift the mind to. You know, it is what it is. That's not my job. I can do that tomorrow, right? Those are all like possible substitutions that, you know, we probably turn to, that there's some level of anxiety in the moment, there's some level of suffering happening. We don't really want to be there with it, and so we substitute. Little patterns like this have been, you know, repeated so many times, they're well ingrained, it's easy to find them, but they may not be skillful. So finding a skillful replacement is important here. Some kind of a substitute that we can really trust. And a lot of these may have worked at times or in situations, but we've learned how to do them and we overuse them. I mean, that's, people recognize that. Yeah. So the other thing about the landing space, it needs to be something that is skillful, that's going to lead to less suffering. It also needs to be something that we can grasp, right? That we can find. Attention is slippery. And if attention is kind of running down this groove in this rut, we have to bounce it out of there. And so there's a looseness to that, and so we need some place, you know, we need a significant landing pad for that attention to find. The deeper the rut, the more obvious the landing pad needs to be. I'm not sure if the analogy is continuing. But anyway, we need a destination that we've practiced finding, right? And part of the reason we need that appropriate landing spot, one that's easy to grasp, is that attention is slippery and it will move off there. So we catch ourselves, we put our attention somewhere, and if it doesn't stay there long enough, it's just gonna go right back. So I'm kind of bustling through my day, hurry, 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 answering email, talking to people, whatever, responding to what's happening. There's this kind of jumble, and I catch myself and I notice, oh, like, I'm caught, I'm busy. And I like, right, I can do this with equanimity. Gotta go. And like, you know, so I don't land that breath. I don't really like feel the settling that I need to be able to see my watch and still hold equanimity, to still kind of be with the moment. So it's usually a little bit longer than we would like, right? That's just as a general heuristic. We need to land something a little bit longer than we think we ought to kind of trust it from there. And then the third piece here is, it's helpful if the place where you put the mind is kind of an opposite, right? It's an antidote to wherever you were the moment before. The classic kind of example here is you're driving along and something happens and anger f- flushes, and you offer metta to whoever surprised you, right? This kind of putting the mind, substituting loving kindness, a metta practice, may you be at ease, may you be happy, instead of, you jerk, I can't believe you did that, like, don't you know how to drive, whatever it may be. So in the teaching of the Brahma Viharas, which describes metta, etc., each of the Brahma Viharas, each of these states of mind have a particular, they're an antidote to something particular. So metta, loving kindness, is an antidote to feelings of anger or fear. You can't hold both anger and metta in the mind at the same time, in the same nen, mind moment. You can't hold anxiety and equanimity in the same mind moment, right? So if you're kind of spinning with anxiety, tense, ambiguity, don't know, whatever, it's a problem at that moment. If you can turn the mind towards equanimity, if that's a landing spot that you have, then that's a great one for that use. That's a real skillful choice. So skillful, graspable, antidote. Three things that make this more effective. So turning to how this is talked about. So that's kind of a more technical, experiential kind of a description of this. This shows up in kind of traditional Buddhist literature, often under the guise of effort. In the Pali sources, it kind of shows up there a lot. You know, we had the Three Robes retreat last month, and I did a Dharma talk close to that about effort and the four kinds of effort. Also, discussions about what's skillful or unskillful may also apply quite directly to substitution practice. There's an example here, the Kusala Sutta. I'm going to read just a little bit here. Abandon what is unskillful. It is possible to abandon what is unskillful. If it were not possible to abandon what is unskillful, I would not say to you, abandon what is unskillful. But because it is possible to abandon what is unskillful, I say to you, abandon what is unskillful. If this abandoning of what is unskillful were conducive to harm and pain, I would not say to you, abandon what is unskillful. But because this abandoning of what is unskillful is conducive to benefit and pleasure, I say to you, abandon what is unskillful. So that's the first part of moving the mind, and then the second part of landing, he has a whole other paragraph which repeats it. So you get the idea. In Zen, the discussions of this kind of practice, substitution, tend to be, well, Zen in general, it's going to be less, less repetitive than the Pali Canon, but it also won't be as explicit. It'll be more metaphorical, and you have to read into it a little more. So an example there from the Blue Cliff Record, case 32. Rinzai is giving a Dharma talk, and one of his students, Joe, comes up to him and says, what is the meaning of the Dharma? Right? What's this all about? And Rinzai steps forward and grabs him, and then slaps him, and then pushes him away. And so Joe's just kind of standing there in front of Rinzai, and he's you know, stunned, he's, you know, paused. And then one of the nearby monks kind of leans over and stage whispers, why don't you bow? And so Joe, like, oh, and he bows, and Kensho, you know, instantly, you know, sees through it. So in this case, you know, so I think like that's a that's a description of this, right? Rinzai is helping him out. So there's the grab, and that's a, like creating this pause, like recognizing in this moment something's not quite right. We have to be aware of that. There's the slap, right? That's substitution, substituting this like intensity of immediate physical sensation for skeptical doubt. You know, this like, is this for me? Am I doing it right? Whatever was kind of underneath that monk's question. And then he lets go, pushes him away, on to the next moment. Don't hold on to it. In that moment of immediacy, there's no space for skeptical doubt. There's no room for anything, right? Just this overflowing experience. So, you know, it's colorful, it's easy to remember. It, you have to read into a little bit to, you know, map this onto specific teachings like this. It's also, you also find it in Zen with like verbiage around like arousing determination. It's in there. Effort. So if you play a little association game and you get a bunch of Zen students like this together in a Zen context, and you ask them, what's the first word that comes to mind when I say effort? My guess is that like probably 20% of you or so are going to say non-effort, right? And kind of rebellious Zen students as you are. And that's where this is going eventually, right? That's the kind of counterpoint to this practice. This kind of trade-off between effort and non-effort, choosing or not choosing with practices like this. So substitution is really useful when we're under-resourced. There's not enough time, we're multitasking, the, you know, conversation has emotional, you know, volatility, or we're deeply invested in it, or something like that. You can use it underwater, you can use it on a bike, you can use it during breakfast with green eggs and ham, right? It's universally, like, it's a nice, simple, effective tactic that you can grab onto and apply. But it's, there's some limitations here. So one of the misses that happens with substitution that's, you know, I think everybody runs into, and everybody runs into multiple times, and it's just, you know, we need to keep checking our rearview mirror for this one, right? It's easy to do, is spiritual bypassing. So it's what happens when the kind of the deep underlying intent is to avoid, when there's a kind of you know, the delusive quality is kind of finding a back door in. So we're, you know, consciously like we're practicing, but there's residue to it. So we see this playing out when we use substitution, when it would actually be more useful, more wholesome, to stay with the original experience, right? Even though it's probably less pleasant. So say I'm feeling some fogginess associated with, you know, emotion of shame, right? And I tell myself, don't dwell on past mistakes, right? And push my attention back to the task at hand. I'm giving a Dharma talk right now. I need to pay attention to that. Right, so that might be an example. Like, we can justify it with practice language, right? We can, you know, hold this self-concept of I'm a good Zen student, I'm a whatever it may be. But there's this subtle like flavor of, you know, I don't really want to come to terms with that. I don't really want to be intimate with this aspect of myself, of my experience. Or, you know, I'm invited into a conversation with someone who's wanting to vent, wanting to have a little mini rant about someone, and I feel conflict, I feel tension and anxiety start to arise, right? And so maybe that would be a smart time to just try to turn the mind towards compassion for the person in front of me. But it may be that compassion is a way of sidestepping that anxiety, right? And it actually leads to collusion with a harmful situation. And it deepens our entrenchment with a pattern of, you know, conflict avoidance or something. So, you know, like we practice in the Sangha, these things get pointed out to us. We catch ourselves by seeing the ripple effects on others. But it can sneak in. So we need to, like, even with this intent to take responsibility, to really hold our practice, to experience less suffering, you know, we miss. We are aiming to look through a window when we bump our head on the wall. It's part of practice. But it's a little easier with substitution because it's so accessible, right? So it's a little bit of a higher risk factor with this one. I find that these practices are most useful. I'm most likely to reach for them when it's kind of a new layer. I'm delving into a new layer of my karmic onion. That there's some kind of new awareness, new relationship to some pattern that I partake of. Some habit, some trigger, and it feels like I want to put intentional energy into it, right? I want to devote something tactile to affecting that, to changing that. Often as we're kind of, you know, so there's been some, you know, the stages of being aware of this are usually vague irritation, and as we get more and more clarity, as we see it, we see that whole arising, you know, flourishing causation sequence more and more clearly, we start to get pretty resistant to it. We start to like really dislike that pattern in ourselves and others. And so then there's this kind of the host of defense mechanisms that we may have to kind of wade through. But as we get clarity about like what it is, that's when it's really useful to like stop adding energy to the equation. So it starts to happen, catch it, move the mind. You know, what's an antidote there? What's something different? You know, not continuing to wear that rut deeper. After we've made progress with our reactivity and response to, you know, some issue, some facet of ourselves, then it's more useful to have more subtler techniques. Have more subtle techniques. We don't need to be so forceful or abrupt in our adjustments. It ends up being kind of too coarse, a little too choppy, right? Like you lose sensitivity when it's too choppy. That's the miss there. That's the downside. And the sensitivity is useful because really what we're trying to do at root is add more and more awareness, right? That's what gives us the leverage for change, for transformation. And the bigger the change we're adding to the system, the harder it is to be finally aware of it. So you know, someone pulls out in front of me, flash anger, start doing meta, that's a pretty big change to the system, right? So I'm not going to, and it cuts it off. So I'm not going to get as much information there. And in the beginning, I don't want that much information, right? Like it's, I just need to not like holler at someone or whatever. But once we can, you know, with some regularity, not holler at folks, more information is better. It's going to speed up that process. And it speeds up that process because we have more insight, right? We understand the arising, right? And it's not so much of a being able to describe it, being able to have this like verbal explanation of it, but it's a matter of giving enough depth of awareness enough times that little changes happen, right? And so the preconditions just don't appear in the same way, right? The conditions are, like the ground is different. So it doesn't have a place to sprout from. Well, sprouts just don't happen. That's what insight's offering. So that's, if we can do that, if we can have those kinds of insights, it's much faster, right? It's a much more effective way of addressing karmic jangles like that. But we don't really have the ability to do that until we've taken some of the edge off a particular issue. And we've done enough of the efforting, enough of the, you know, these kinds of more basic practices. So there's a lot of layers to our karmic onion, right? And in different circumstances, you know, we have many different selves. We're at different depths. And so it's not like after, you know, 6.5 years of meditation practice, you'll be done with the substitution phase and you can move on to like, you know, open awareness, right? It doesn't lay out quite so easily. It's always relevant, right? It's just noting the context, noticing what's arising. So this brings us back to kind of the effort, non-effort part of things. A version of this came up in the Wednesday night foundational teachings class that Shinyu and I are teaching. We were talking about, this last Wednesday, we were talking about the 12-fold chain of dependent origination. And there was this question about, so the kind of the really fun part of this is that is the middle part of the chain where craving turns into grasping, really. There's feeling, craving, grasping all in a row, and that's kind of the pivot point. And so the question was like, well, what about, you know, the desire for something wholesome, you know, this wish to practice, this wish to save other beings, this, you know, that kind of thing. Isn't that a kind of craving? And doesn't that lead to a kind of grasping? And then do we want that or do we not want that? And so, yeah, all grasping is going to continue to condition, to recondition this, you know, establishment of this sense of self, right? So when there's grasping, it changes who we become, right? It's first verse of the Dhammapada, like the thought today is going to change who we are tomorrow. That's a bad paraphrase, sorry. But you get the idea. So desire is both You can have wholesome and unwholesome desires. It's all going to lead to, it's all conditioned, right? So it's possible to act unconditioned. But again, that's like, you know, the difference between substitution and a more open awareness. Like, you got to do a lot of wholesome conditioned action before you have moments of unconditioned action. So I have another excerpt from the Pali Canon here. If a monk attains concentration, attains singleness of mind founded on desire, that is called concentration founded on desire. He generates desire, endeavors, arouses persistence, upholds and exerts his intent for the sake of the non-arising of evil, unskillful qualities that have not yet arisen, for the sake of the abandoning of evil, unskillful qualities that have arisen, for the sake of the arising of skillful qualities that have not yet arisen, and for the maintenance, non-confusion, increase, plentitude, development, and culmination of skillful qualities that have arisen. So yeah, desire is an important part of practice. And it kind of moves the question to, so what's the difference between skillful desire and unwholesome desire, unskillful desire? And the short answer is that attachment is unskillful, right? The more attachment there is, the more unskillful it is. Attachment meaning a kind of intensification of that desire, right? A kind of concreteness about it. The medium answer is that, the long answer is kind of a talk unto itself, so we're not going to go there, but I'll give you a medium version. The medium answer is that desire is a necessary element of exertion, right? We have to want to do something, to change something, to affect something in order to give effort to it. The path of practice takes effort, and so it needs desire. And so our intentions, our impulses, lead to action. You know, we feel determination, and these are going to condition future versions of ourself. But that those future selves that are conditioned by that desire for practice are going to be happier, right? They'll experience less suffering than otherwise. So desire is most wholesome when it's supported by a mind which is suffused with equanimity. So if I'm, say I'm biking and I have a desire for safety, you know, that's wholesome enough in a general way, right? If I'm challenged and say someone cuts me off, right? There's an adrenaline response. Can I stay in touch with that experience, right? With that desire for safety with equanimity? Or does, like, the immediacy of it, does the intensity of it kind of push the equanimity out of the way? So I think we, you know, recognize that, you know, we have a mixed track record on this. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. If I can't, saying that, this happened to me just recently, last week, and I responded with anger, right? And that doesn't contribute to a mind with less suffering, or a world with less suffering. It's not a skillful use of my attention. And, you know, kind of looking back at it through this lens, like, I did a bypass substitution there, right? I chose righteousness as a alternative. That was looked like a real good landing spot at that moment. It was a lot better than, you know, feeling that intensity of vulnerability or embarrassment or whatever else was there. So, bummer. Conditioned my whole evening. So desire is less wholesome when there's more self bound up in it, right? There's more attachment, more self-identity. So another thing to think about here, thinking about the usefulness of this kind of technique in a given instance, is it kind of boils down to opportunity cost. Right, this is where, like the Shikantaza police give you a ticket, and this is Dogen saying Zazen is not meditation practice. Right, it's there's something available which is deeper and more thorough and more subtle than labeling thoughts or scanning the body or counting the breath or directing attention. Substituting compassion, whatever it may be. When we do something to change the content of mind, right? It's expressing this kind of subtle preference. So we all deal with this the entirety of the time that we spend in meditation, right? This is up as a koan. Well, not the entirety, but a lot of it, right? So, you know the piece from Shantideva where he's talking about how difficult it would be to cover the entire earth in a continuous sheet of leather, right? That would be a really hard thing to do. But if you did that, then you'd be able to walk anywhere without discomfort. No problem, right? And he says, like, you know, there's a better way to do this. Wear sandals, right? And that's basically Buddhism's answer here. Like, don't go around trying to cover the world in leather. Like, put on sandals. Rather than trying to change everything around you so that it fits your preferences, which, you know, given impermanence and given the fact that we have contradictory preferences, it's not going to happen. It's much easier, as difficult as it is, it's much easier to change our relationship to that content, right? To adjust the mind, adjust how these preferences are showing up and how we relate to them. So it's an analogy for grasping. It's also an analogy in a more subtle way for meditation. Right, it's a looser analogy because the difference between wearing sandals and coating the earth and leather is pretty big, whereas the distinction between, you know, substitution practice and Shikantaza is not as big. So there's a lot of things that we do skillfully in meditation, which is more like covering the earth in leather, right? The right is meditation which have a fixed object of attention, where we keep bringing the mind back to something in particular as we notice it's disappeared, gotten distracted. It sounds a little like bad Shikantaza propaganda. It's not that it's bad to count the breath, right? It's not that, or label thoughts, or do a body scan, or whatever it is. In each case, there's times when we're following an impulse that's, you know, fueled by desire. It's an expression of preference. It's, you know, if we take a drink of water, or we turn up the heat, or we skip an advertisement on YouTube, right? Those aren't bad things to do. They're not like inherently immoral or problematic, but they're all expressions of preference. They're all ways in which we try to put a little more leather out there, make it a little bit easier to get by. And it's possible to do those things without preference. So that's what Rinzai is demonstrating there. That out of this deep stillness of mind, There's an immediacy available, right? Wisdom mind is present. It's happening. If we deeply pause, if we really stop with enough intensity, it's there. It doesn't mean that we're frozen. It doesn't mean that we are numb or can't act, can't respond. We can. There's a immediacy, a spontaneity to it. When everything is cleared out, something bright can emerge, and that's unconditioned activity. So we get those moments. They happen, they float through. But much of our time is spent in doing these kinds of practices in which we are directing. Or more like Shikantaza, we are allowing. It's practice to allow those unconditioned moments to happen, right? We don't cause them. Right? We kind of condition our readiness to receive them. So if we substitute too quick, if we're spiritual bypassing or something like that, it's just not as transformative as it could be. There's a little too much on the side of intentional practice, of trying to get somewhere. And not enough discovery, not enough surprise. We need Rinzai to slap us, we need that pause. It's just the experiencing itself, experiencing with that much clarity, with that much spaciousness. That's what changes our relationship to conditions. We don't have to do something with it, right? We don't have to adjust, refine. It's just meeting it with that level of intimacy. It's just that it's really hard to do. It's a moving target and it moves fast. I think that's what I have for today. Questions or comments, please.
Thanks for your talk. I've had the experience of having some intrusive thought or something, and then trying to replace it with like a mantra or a saying or something. And I think it's sort of like what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. But I've had the experience that it sort of makes those experiences more frequent. It's mm-hmm. like the more I attend to it, be like, oh, this thing is threatening, then the more I kind of have those thoughts. And then that was one mm-hmm. comment, and the other one was that that when I think about replacing an experience that seems threatening or negative, then I'm no longer occupying the spot where I had that experience. I'm occupying the spot where I think I'm gonna be once I fix it. Mm-hmm. And I think there's this missed opportunity there, at least for me. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Yeah, nice. So for the first one, in the koan, first Rinzai grabs him, and then there's a slap, right? So there's that, there has to be that moment of, like, letting the awareness in of what it is. And, as we kind of practice a particular shift, a particular I'm going to use this mantra instead. It can jump in too soon, right? Where it's kind of reflexive. It's just conditioned, and we're not really applying it with intent. And for that intent to arise, we have to feel that suffering first. We have to wish it was otherwise. And So if it's just a new part of this rut, you've just kind of like done a little detour, but you're still in that rut, it doesn't really help. Yeah, so that's kind of in the bypass category. And then, now remind me of the second part.
Just that when you do the replacement practice, then you're no longer occupying that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it, you know, when I do that, like, immediately there's a little bit of relief, you know, it's a matter of like, instead of being this situation, I'm watching this situation, right? I'm noticing it in myself. And so there's that, the extra awareness that goes with noticing something happening, right? Where I'm attending to like relationship as well as content. And it just, that in and of itself, that just initial piece brings some ease, some more relaxation around it. As the mind is moved and kind of lands, it's not going to stay there forever. Like, it's going to start to go places. And I think that becomes really interesting. Once, if you know that it's landed long enough, to kind of see like, okay, so then what are the departures that want to happen from there? So that would become an interesting question, I think. Taicho and Ember. Right, there's one.
Raise hand.
Oh, higher up. Front row.
Front row.
Thank you. I have this example of waking up in the middle of the night, this intense fear of suffocating. And there's underlying physical condition, like, you know, I have allergy and, mm-hmm. you know, my nasal path is kind of clogged. But this fear is really intense, and I still know that, well, I can just breathe through my mouth, but mm-hmm. it's 3 a.m. in the morning, I wake up, that doesn't help, mm-hmm. and I have this intense fear, and it's unbearable, mm-hmm. and... So what I usually do is just get up, go downstairs and read, or, you know, look at the Facebook or something for just a few minutes, mm-hmm. and it dissipates. Mm-hmm. So that's my substitution. Mm-hmm. It really works.
Yeah.
I can go back to bed and I can sleep. But at the same time, I mean, I think you're right that I'm missing I can't say that I want to experience that more, but
right.
But there's something there that I'm also curious, but it's just stay with it without any, like, not trying to escape from it, mm-hmm. is almost seems impossible. If maybe I can just try to do, okay, I'll do 5 seconds or something like that, but how do you even do that?
Sure. So that, I mean, that's a great example. And, you know, like, you know, that's part of the art of this, is recognizing what's available. You know, and if the situation is too intense, like, we're not going to win that, right? Like, it's not, we don't really have the capacity to just be with, you know, right. imminent death, right? Like, no. Perhaps. So, you know, like, that's okay. You know, like, if and also, like, when there's that much, like, kind of physical component to it, like, emotionally or, like, bodily, it takes a while for that to clear out, right? Like, there's just a chemical enough reaction that it takes time to sort of smooth that over and come back. So, you know, I would say, first off, have compassion for yourself, and secondly, what I mean by that is really allow, you know, whatever it happens to be like, and it's okay. And as you have flexibility, as you have the ability, lean into it, like see what you can challenge. You know, we want to stay on a learning edge. We don't want to, you know, push ourselves into panic and shutdown and, you know, have enough of a like trauma with it that we don't want to go back. Okay. So that's the kind of skillfulness of knowing what you can take.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for your talk. Mm-hmm. I think that my question is along the lines of how do we tell when we're spiritual bypassing? The example I can think of is so I'm on barista station in the cafe. It's very busy.
Mm-hmm.
And the sort of expectation surrounding me is mm-hmm. that I move very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I notice that I'm getting lost in that, so I slow down.
Sure.
But that creates a conflict.
With others around you and the yes. environment as a whole, yeah.
So there's a few different things that I can do. Mm-hmm. I can continue to slow down and try to be mindful of what my body needs mm-hmm. and my awareness, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of neglect people around me, or I can try to move very quickly and just get in, like get through the day in hopes that that means I'm being kind to others.
Sure.
So, like, what's the right way?
I mean, it's a similar to Daicho's, really, in that we have to watch it play out again and again, and we make different choices at different times. Like, what, you know, how much do you have available? You can, you know, you'll just have to keep trying that. The in terms of like recognizing the spiritual bypass, I think that was like the kind of the core part of that question was it doesn't feel good, right? When we're trying to not notice something, it feels kind of small and kind of slippery. And We want to get to know that, because that's like that's ignorance. That's this kind of choosing not to understand how the world works, and it's a very basic sensation. And if you can catch that happening, you can see all the ripples of that happening. You can see all the like the ways it shows up. And so, you know, you're in a cafe. It's loud. You're feeling stress. You can check like, oh, I have a motivation to like kind of pause and go inward. Is there that sense of like not wanting to see, right? So get to know that like kind of root sensation of delusion, and then you can find it in more and more complex situations. That's like a lifetime practice, but start. Yeah.
Look for an element of not wanting to see.
Yeah, yeah. And if you find that, then that's a pretty good clue that, yeah, a bypassing might be going on there, and maybe I'd need to be a little more open to this experience.
Okay.
What's it actually like? Let it hit me.
Thank you.
So that kind of, like, you know, you titrate between Daicho's answer and Amber's answer there.